How would you define an addiction to pornography?
The first thing I'd say, yes, it is controversial as to whether we call looking repeatedly at pornography an addiction.
Welcome to Crime Scene Gold Coast with Guardian Criminal Law. My name's Mark Savick. I'm the principal of Guardian Criminal Law, and we'll be bringing you podcasts weekly. Variety of topics that can be very sensitive, so please be careful when you're listening, and if you need any assistance at all, we'll include a lifeline number at the bottom of the page. Really appreciate you subscribing and liking our podcast channel. You can listen to us across most social media platforms, Spotify, YouTube, TikTok, and you'll find us there. We look forward to bringing you many episodes in the future. People's sexuality, which, you know, people are talking about this all the time. We've got the LGBTIQ plus. There's a variety of views and stances that are taken in this sort of space. So I think it's pretty well accepted that a person who's homosexual is attracted to the same sex is born with that. That's a sexual trait that they're born with that develops during puberty, and it was predetermined, as you're speaking earlier, it's predetermined that they would be attracted to a same-sex partner. Yeah. And that starts in puberty to come to the fore and then be expressed in that attraction. I've also learnt through some cases that I've conducted that sometimes when that's emerging, your sexuality is emerging, and homosexuality may be emerging for you, that there's a tendency to experiment with other types of sexuality. So being heterosexual, for example, in those developmental years, because there could be some self-denial by the person thinking that if they had heterosexual sex, it'll flick a switch and they don't have to cope with so-called coming out. Does this attraction towards children, does that develop around that those stages of puberty start to reveal itself then as well? And if so, what sort of behavioural traits do we see amongst teenagers when those urges are coming to the fore?
Look, I agree. Genetically, our sexuality is a given, almost determined. And of course, one could argue if it's a determined, then how can I be held responsible? Well, because and yes, pedophilia can fit the that category as well. But there's still an element of choice, and we still learn as we grow up, and we learn to have empathy, and we learn that certain things are wrong, and we learn that certain things are inappropriate. But as we come to that pubescent stage, as you were developing it, and we start to become more aware of our sexual feelings, and in fact, whether you're gay or straight, you can have that orientation to both ways at that time, and you just might grow in a certain way past that. Past puberty. But there are other factors that can determine our comfortableness with the opposite sex or the same sex. For example, we might have experiences where we are shy of the opposite sex and we just feel more comfortable with the same sex. And we also might just happen to have physical attractions and not be particularly attracted to the opposite sex. And for some males, they just have low sexual arousal. They don't have high testosterone and they mightn't be particularly sexual at all, or their sexuality mightn't start to develop till their 20s, or they mightn't be particularly interested in it if they've got very low sexual urges. Of course, you can take care of that medical by getting things like testosterone patches if you want to be so inclined. But some people are happy being alone and living alone. So what you experience in your teenage years is very fundamental, and what you fantasize is very fundamental. And if, you know, most boys will fantasize about, you know, naked female adult pictures or want to look at girly magazine, not necessarily girls their own age. What you actually masturbate to will reinforce that fantasies. So if you find yourself attracted to the same sex and you're masturbating that fantasy, you're reinforcing that. So you're naturally going to become excited to the same sex, and you're more comfortable with the same sex. Look, pedophilia is complex, but certainly there's a whole lot of social factors, social shyness, social inhibition, and feeling uncomfortable, getting on well with their peers, and then starting to fantasize about children, reinforcing that fantasy. We know if you look at, say, rapist or adult rapist, the first time a rapist rapes is about 15, and they come from those aggressive bullying types, and they go on to become adult rapist, whereas the first pedophile act probably doesn't occur till they're about 19 or in their 20s. Average age is about 28, so in their late 20s. So it's well and truly formed, but a bit later than the aggressive type. It's not that they're not fantasizing or thinking about it. It's that they have just developed an attraction for little children, always felt more comfortable with children, and in fact, maybe not even thought about sex at all with children. They just enjoy being around with children, enjoy doing things with children. In fact, probably have natural great teaching gifts for children, enjoy children. And in most of their interactions with children are normal and healthy. But because of other factors in their life, such as social shyness and inhibition, at a time when they're feeling aroused and the child is available, then they will use that child sexually because it's convenient. And they will tell themselves, the child loves me, or I'm teaching the child, or yeah, someone will do it anyway, so it might as well be me. And look, in some cases, and I'm not talking about the psychopathic pedophile, because they're the dangerous ones. They're the ones that will kill. They're the ones that will torture and do serious harm. But you will get the gentle pedophile who will make the experience very pleasurable for young children. But yes, I've come across horrific cases of fathers against their own children starting at two. Yeah. And teaching their brothers and sisters to have sex with each other in their bath at five. These are people who very much have an underlying deviant sexual arousal, a strong genetic base towards their attraction. It's what they fantasize. It's about what turns them on most. Particularly with males, not so much females, but with males, unfortunately, we are driven by what stimulates, what can get us to arousal the quickest, and what can stimulate us the most. So we will fantasize about the same fantasy over and over again. We'll have favorite fantasies. You know, for some it might be blonde, big women, or redheads, adult women. But for some, it might be little children, because that gets them to the arousal. That gives them the arousal much quicker. There was a lot of research done back in the 80s in America. He got permission from the Attorney General. The name won't come to me at the moment. I'll have to look that up and come back to you on that. But he got permission to research hundreds of thousands of males and females across America.
I think I know the name. Yes. It's on top tip of my tongue.
Yeah. He used what we call a plethysmograph machine, which measures your sexual arousal, and it is on for women and men. In my earlier career in the early 90s, we had one in the prison at the Moreton, the sex offenders jail then, and we would use that machine to measure sexual arousal. And
you've got to tell us about the machine. What does the machine look
well,
like?
Well, it's
how is it attached to a person?
A computer-based machine that measures blood pressure, brain waves, skin resistance, and has attachments for females and males that you can measure your sexual arousal. This is all done very professionally and privately. You teach the offender how to place it and on privately. He goes on and he does it in a private room, places it on, and then you might give him fantasies to think about, and you can measure his sexual arousal level to certain kind of stimuli, deviant or pedophilia stimuli. And I you can look up my work on this by Gavin Polk. I published it in 2004 called Habituation and Dishabituation of Deviant Sexual Arousal.
We'll make sure we've got a link to that.
Yeah, and we identified psychopaths on the hair psychopathic test, which I talked about earlier, so I had to get a score of 30, and we were particularly looking at serial rapists, adult rapists, and serial child molesters, and we were trying to see if what was happening neurally in their brains when they were thinking about this, and whether they could habituate. So habituation is a normal learning response that occurs in every species, right from the insect to the man. It's an innate survival mechanism that when you feel comfortable, you habituate. So, for example, a rabbit's in the field, he sees the farmer come along, his hairs goes up and he runs away. But if he sees the farmer coming every day and the farmer doesn't bother him, he keeps eating, he becomes comfortable. So for adults, it might be watching a football game, and when a goal is kicked, you get excited. So, and you stand up, and then after the goal is gone and the play gets down, you habituate, you become more comfortable. So for sexual arousal, you got what is occurring is habituation and dishabituation. It's ongoing all the time. So habituation is when you are exposed to the same stimulus constantly, your arousal becomes less. And the pornography industry is very familiar with this, and this is why they're so successful, and they change their material all the time. Because particularly males become bored with looking at the same naked lady repeatedly. Their response becomes, it's not bored, it's called habituation. Your arousal becomes less, so you need a new stimulus to dishabituate. What we found in our research is most men will habituate. They will go to orgasm and then they'll habituate. They will relax. They will have a disinhibiting effect will occur to deviant material or stimuli. It will be a turn off to them. So what we found with serial rapists and serial pedophiles is they don't habituate. They stay stimulated and they have to go through with the act. They sort of can't control it. They can't disinhibit. And going back to that earlier research I was talking about from the Attorney General's permission in the USA, where he looked at hundreds of thousands of men, what he found was all people can be attracted to all sorts of stimulus, a sexual stimulus, but we have a preference. So if you're straight, you might have a preference for, you know, seeing romantic pictures, you know, or images of a boy and girl holding hand and kissing, and your stimulation is much higher for that. you may get stimulated by gay sex, but it won't be as high and as powerful. So we're always attracted to that which is going to be most stimulating for us. That will be our preference that will guide us. And that's where we get that dichotomy of bisexuality. In a sense, one could argue that particularly males, not so much women, that males have all sorts of deviancies, but they have a higher preference for one, and so they stick to that preference. We know, for example, is that violent rapists will be stimulated mostly by rape scenes, and pedophiles they'll be stimulated by straight scenes and normal sex scenes, but they'll be much more stimulated. Their erectile girth will be much stronger and more powerful to children. And the same with gay, same attracted sex. Their sexual stimulation, both for females and males, will be much stronger for the same sex, even though they might be aroused by the opposite sex. It'll just be more powerful. So, yeah, it's going back to that neural basis, that genetic basis, which we were talking about, that can impact upon us. But it still comes down to a choice. It's not uncontrollable. It's not a mental disease in the sense that you can't control your desire to touch children. You might have the desires, you might have the fantasies, but you can control them. And even with treatment, and there are treatments available, you can reduce it and eliminate it and change the fantasy. We call it aversion therapy. And there are some drugs available too that will reduce your sexual desire and your erectile functioning, as well as interfere with your fantasy as well. So it is a choice. And those desires can be controlled.
I've been involved in several cases, and I'm sure that you have also come across this. And I was interested in your view. Cases of historical sexual assault where the male perpetrator is in their late teens, early 20s, the victims, sometimes related to the accused, are younger, so they might be 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. The person accused has no criminal record history. They seem to have quite a good family life. And then post this period, so after they're 20, 21, there's no record of any sort of offending, and they enter into a healthy adult relationship, quite often with a lady or with the same sex partner, but a healthy adult relationship, and they don't offend anymore. And then the charges are brought when they're about 30, 35, their historical sexual assault charges. And they're brought because of some sort of stimulus that's come about that's encouraged or given the victim enough courage to go and make a complaint. It may come out of them growing and maturing a little bit more and realizing what had happened to them. So where do these perpetrators fit? I mean, there's no record. There seems to be a normal upbringing. Doesn't seem to be any mental health issues. Then there's this period of offending, and it seems to be during the time of their own sexual development as well, but they're using children during that time. And then it drops away and disappears.
Yes. Well, there's sexual offending is very complex and very difficult to classify, but there are some classification systems. We have what's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders that don't classify sex offending very well. They do mention paedophilia. They certainly give some factors or descriptions of what a paedophilia is or triggers for it to fit that criteria. But there are better classification systems, and if I can sort of mention one simply that might describe three types of sex offenders. And we're talking about pedophilia behaviour, a bit more complex for rapists. But in terms of pedophilia, if we can describe it simply in terms of a situational sex offender, where they don't particularly have a preference or interest in children, but the child's available and it's out of convenience. And they act because the child's available, and sometimes there's alcohol and drugs are involved, and sometimes they're just too damn lazy to go out and find a lady of their own age or to go perhaps to a brothel. We have the second type of sex offender we call the morally indiscriminate, which is more the antisocial type person. They do it because they can. They will do a break and enter, if there's a little girl there, they'll take them. They're morally indiscriminate. They will take children, they will take girls, they'll take your car. They have that lack of empathy. What we have called is elevated psychopathic traits, if you like. They're morally indiscriminate. They just simply don't care. Then you have people for genuine mental health problems. We put them into the psychiatric sex offender. It might be they're intellectually disabled, or they might have other psychiatric problems. Again, they have an attraction for young children because that's who they are, and they have a psychiatric problem. The case you're talking about, the 19-year-old or late teenage-year-old, more fits the category of the situational offender. There could be other factors at play there. He could be emotionally and sexually immature. He might be an 18 or 19-year-old, but with the mind and sexuality of a 14 or 15-year-old. It could be there could be other factors that he's looking at, pornography that disinhibits. If you're exposed to sexual material at a young age, or if you experience sexual abuse when you're a child, you become sexualized and sex becomes less meaningful. I enjoyed it. It was okay for me. He will enjoy it. Just like you, I've had cases where men coming back from the war commit sexual offences against their niece or even their own daughters. They're not pedophiles. They're not attracted to sex to children. But they're drinking. They're suffering post-traumatic stress. They're left alone with babysitting the niece or the stepdaughter. They're cuddling, watching a movie, they're disinhibited. So you've got a whole lot of factors there. So there's a difference between a genuine pedophile who's genuinely attracted to children. They don't need the addition of alcohol or other factors. They will go looking for those children and they will find them and they will groom them. And there's certainly that category. But in your case, he's realised what he's done is wrong. He's decided not to do it again. So he's got full control. So there's no intellectual problems, no psychiatric problems.
That's right, that's right.
Very, very situational.
Yeah.
There may have been some emotional and sexual immaturity involved in it, or some alcohol, which alcohol and drugs will always have that disinhibiting effect. I mean, yeah. I've seen normal, healthy men who are attracted to appropriate age sex when they're on ice and when they're on cocaine. And I'm trying not to be I'm trying to be discreet in the way I say this without coming across too rude, but they will have sex with anything and anyone, animals, babies. They just simply don't care and don't know what they're doing. And half the time they don't remember it, and they'll be shocked by it.
On that point, that was leading me to another question. You've sort of preempted it. The accused reaction to the alleged offence. So what I've seen in the past, I had one case in particular that involved a lot of child pornography. Mm. So the individual hadn't been charged with any direct sexual offences involving victims, but indirectly, of course, through his collection of child pornography. And it was, they grade child pornography in legal cases, and this was the highest of grades. I did manage to avoid looking at that evidence, as the matter ended up, it was a Commonwealth charge and it ended up being a guilty plea. So the individual that was charged, when I first conducted the interview, he presented as somebody totally without emotion whatsoever and without movement, and he was just staring straight at me. Mm. And he had an appearance that was, he was trying to look very pure, very clean cut, very, very clean cut. And he refused to, he didn't answer any of my questions. He just maintained eye contact. And he was almost feigning mental health, a mental health issue. So when he first appeared before the court, it ended up being, I know it's not a place to tell a joke, but this is what happened, that the magistrate was in court. I entered the courtroom. My client then was brought in from the cells into the dock. And there's a little raised timber section, like wall of the dock, and then the remainder is glass and then wire. He walked into the dock. I said to the magistrate, my client's before the court. We looked over and he disappeared. So he'd prostrated himself on the floor behind that little timber, well, gave the appearance of him disappearing somehow fantastically. And so as I started working through this matter, there was no evidence of any mental illness at all. He was working in quite a trusted position, in a government position, and he was working with technology. He had computers. And his family reported that he had quite a good upbringing. He had lots of opportunities. He studied. He's been working. And there have been no issues whatsoever. So this, to me, and I've seen this before, it smacks of massive denial. It's like, it's almost as if the brain goes into a state where it wants to protect itself from the admission that you've committed such a heinous act. And I've seen it several times. And during the course of dealing with the client, taking them through a certain journey, explaining things to them, quite often providing them with a way of explaining their behavior, through the assistance of psychologists and psychiatrists, that they can sometimes come to accept that they've done a bad thing, but there's a pathway for them forward and they don't have to be a bad person, that they've done something bad. And so they come out of this, what appears to be mental health illness state. Have you seen that yourself? And I'm sure there's some sort of explanation for this, because I've seen it on several occasions with particularly heinous crimes.
In this instance, you're talking about child pornography, or child exploitation material, which is what
exactly.
Criminal Code talks about,
yes.
Which is an interesting field in itself. I have treated men who have been senior officers in the Army and other services who look at this material, and retired men from the services as well. Public servants, in your case, are high profile.
I've had
public,
medical
public
professionals.
Services, yeah. Medical professional doctors. And yes, some will say, they often will say, I came across it accidentally. I'm not sure how you do that.
I can answer that.
You can.
I can answer that to some extent. And I'll answer it in this way, in that I have, through the course of my professional career, I've had to look at certain sites because claims were made by individuals with regard to coming across pornography accidentally. And there are pornographic sites where if you enter a search term, and the search term, I don't know, it could be large breasts in the search term. And then it'll provide a range of photographs that you can click on to play a video of a lady with large breasts. And in amongst all of those photographs, quite often, to my surprise, is an image of somebody that looks like they're underage. Whether they are or not, I don't know. But in my view, the person looks like they're under 18, well under 18. So that material can present itself. And I have never gone down that rabbit hole of searching, like opening that image
and another. No, you haven't clicked into it, Mark. No, that's the issue. They click into it.
Yes, but it does present itself. Like yeah, I was very doubtful of that when I first started doing these cases. And I was very doubtful of it. They go, oh, I was looking at such and such a site and it just came up and I clicked it and then before you know it. Yeah. But, yeah, that's the point. And the point is what you're making. There's a choice.
The point I'm making it is
that's right.
It's not an accident. It is possible, I agree, to come across it accidentally, but it's in a fingerprint size and you think, oh, that's a bit dodgy. I'll have a look out of curiosity. But when you have a look at it, a normal person will say, oh, God, that's disgusting.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to go back there again.
Yeah.
That's just totally off.
Yes, yes, yes,
but
yes, exactly.
The person who's attracted to that kind of material, to children performing sex acts on men or women or adult women, young boys, underage boys, underage girls, look at it again and again and again. It's not a one-off.
That's right.
So therefore, it's quite a serious problem. You can't say you're not getting aroused to it. And in some cases, they masturbate to it, they enjoy it, and they're having a beer while they're doing it or a bong while they're doing it. And it becomes a habit and a pattern. I will accept that in some cases it can be very brief over a few days or weeks, and they just decide, no, that's not appropriate. You certainly see that among some of the professional people that I've come across, medical people, doctors usually, who will look at it for a brief period and then say, oh, it's too late. They've got caught because they've looked at it again and again, and it's drawn their attention to Interpol, who's then contacted the relevant federal police in Australia, who's contacted Argus Task Force in Queensland. You get a knock on the door. So it has to be a repetitive behaviour to get to that level, at least enough to draw the attention. I might add that I've had barristers in that situation who they've been entrapped a bit, lonely and etc. And some professionals who get entrapped by undercover policewomen posing as ladies interested in those sorts of things. And so that, yes, these people are not normally attracted to that material, but have other underlying issues of depression, particularly major depression and loneliness, and wanting to have a conversation with a normal adult. And they'll even go to the extent of lying. They'll say they've had a daughter and they've had sex with a daughter and they don't even have a daughter, or that their daughter's done certain things to them and they don't even have one. They're doing it, and that counts as child pornography because they're talking about it in text or on social pages, and it constitutes an offence. But their motive isn't, even though heinous and totally disgusting, their motive is major depression and loneliness, not pedophilia as such. But yes, in terms of people who look and look and look but don't have contact, no contact offences, they're voyeurist, and they are attracted to that material. Certainly active pedophiles would prefer the real thing, but they too look at this material. What the research doesn't quite know yet, and we need a lot more work in this field, is how do we take the voyeurist who has no contact offenders and identify which one of them are going to become an actual contact offender. And if we could do that, we might be able to set up some preventative type programs or get in early. But certainly that's the starting point, is that voyeuristic behavior. In some cases, there's no alcohol and drug involved. But in a lot of cases, you've got, again, as I've talked about earlier, the disinfecting effects of substances. They might be looking at adult material. They're already aroused. And then somehow they've come across this child pornography. They're partially aroused and they find it curious. They may not be as powerfully as aroused to adult, but they keep looking. Or alternatively, what happens with addiction to pornography, and I feel immensely sorry for any person who has an addiction, whether it's gambling, alcohol, drugs, or pornography, adult or CEM.
What does addiction to pornography look like? I think that I'm good with addiction to alcohol and addiction to drugs, but what's behavioral addiction, like that sort of addiction? Because I can understand alcohol, there's chemicals involved. Well, I suppose with the pornography, there's chemicals involved that are in one's, released by one's own brain. Mm. But how would you define an addiction to pornography?
Okay, the first thing I'd say, yes, it is controversial as to whether we saw, whether we call looking repeatedly at pornography an addiction. But in my view, if you're looking at it 7 or 8 hours a day and you're masturbating 7 times or 8 times a day, which some men do, don't know how, but they do it, it's a very, very serious problem. And it's a very strong addiction that they can't pull themselves away from it. And they get so addicted and desensitized that they start looking for more and more material because of that habituation effect.
Yeah.
So they're looking for other material that will give them that excitation. So similar in the sense of gambling, they can't pull themselves away from that gambling, that poker machine or blackjack at the casino. They've got to go back and go back. Even though they know they're losing, they can't set limits and they can't walk away. Some men can set limits. I've got a good friend who says $200, and when I've lost that $200, I keep enough for a cab, I'm going home. Sometimes he's won and lost as much as $20,000, $30,000. Mm. But when he's lost that $200, he'll go home. Yeah. And he regards that as, good entertainment. And he doesn't feel bad about it. But he couldn't stop him from walking. He couldn't walk away at winning $10,000 or $15,000. But he was happy, but he could set those limits. See, I don't call that an addiction. He's got complete control. He's made a decision. He set a limit. So someone who can't set limits, someone who drinks to the point where they're drunk, someone who keeps masturbating despite it being almost painful and hurtful and causing physical problems, is quite a serious problem.
Methamphetamine's a big problem in that space.
Yep, cocaine, and they'll just keep doing it. And as I said, that desensitization or habituation, if you like, and they'll start looking for more and more material, and that's when they venture into the bestiality. That's when they venture into the pedophilia, looking for that that arousal, if you like. Again, like all things in psychology, it's the causal factors are multi. It's not just about the addiction. It's about the loneliness. It's about wanting to escape stress. It's about vegging out. Some men like me like to veg out and watch old 1950 movies and Gone with the Wind and Sound of Music 100 times over and over again. That is how I veg out. And that is how I cope with stress or depression. I veg out from the world. But for other men, it is pornography. And I'm thankful that that's not me.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to judge a person because they prefer adult pornography. But if it's causing stress in their life and causing stress in their family, I mean, I've had wives bring their husbands to me saying they're sick of it. He comes home every night. He doesn't help me in the kitchen. He doesn't play with the kids. He goes in with his beer and turns on the porn and stays there for 2 or 3 hours and comes out for dinner.
Wow.
And they come and they bring them to me wanting treatment and for them to fix it up. And it does get quite serious because you've got young children growing up in a house where a man's watching pornography.
Right.
They could enter the room. They could come across it accidentally. And you see that in a generational where I've had sons and fathers. You know, the father's gone to jail for watching CEM. Hasn't watched it till he's retired.
CEM.
Child exploitation material.
Absolutely.
Child pornography. And the wife, the daughter-in-law is bringing the son to me, saying he's got an adult condition, and he'll tell me, well, that's when I was a 9-year-old, I'd go and knock off my dad's videos, and that's where I learned it, and my brother did too. We've been doing it all our lives. I'm not hurting anyone.
It's not
child pornography. What's the problem? Well, it is a problem. It's a problem because you're not spending time with your wife or your children, and you're denying them of parenting and loving attention, and it can result in the breakdown of your marriage. Otherwise than that, they're decent, hardworking men.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I call an addiction is something that causes harm or stress. And this is why I would argue strongly, although there would be those that would disagree with me, that pornography is an addiction when you can't set limits, when you can't control it. Particularly when it causes stress and harm, and when it leads to illegal behavior.
So the pedophile goes to jail for 5 years, 10 years. They get let out on parole or they've completed their sentence. What's the best way for the community to deal with pedophiles coming back into the community? What's the best way to try to ensure that there's no repeat offending?
Well, the research is very interesting in that. I might just deal with the worst types, the dangerous sex offenders, which sometimes have been subjected to indefinite sentencing laws, which have been regarded as controversial and often a waste of time, where they're subjected to 5 and 10, and some are still on 20 years orders, but the standard is a 5-year supervision order. So they're kept in past their sentence because they've been assessed by 2 psychiatrists as being an unacceptable risk to the community, and then eventually released on strict supervision conditions under the Dangerous Sex Offenders Act, where they're subject to attending a psychologist or psychiatrist for treatment, they're subject to strict reporting, and they're subject to a child sex registrar and visits from the police, and also sometimes a police psychologist accompany the police. How dangerous are these people really? When I've looked at the research, the general research across the world on a heterosexual pedophile, the recidivism is about 13%. Yes, one will argue that that's low, that any recidivism is dangerous, and I agree. But when you compare that to property offending, and violent offending, where you're getting up into the 30% and the 50% recidivism rate, it's considerably less. But one would argue, one, we don't want any. In terms of the homosexual pedophile, the recidivism average around the world is about 90%. myself and my PhD student looked at research. Rowlands is his name, and his research is published, looking at the Queensland Dangerous Sex Offenders Act and about 120 men placed on that. So he looked at that several years before and several years after, and he looked at recidivism rates and their progress on that orders. What he found was that about 50% of those people on those orders breached the orders, but most were for technical breaches in the sense of failure to report, failure to keep appointments, what we call technical breaches, or testing positive for cannabis.
Yeah.
In terms of reoffending, sexual reoffending, it was 7%. And the argument could be said that the government's spending an awful lot of money managing these people on very strict supervision when they could be easily managed on, most of them easily managed on ordinary parole orders. The difficulties, of course, is that amongst that group are some very serious repetitive offenders. And again, it's difficult to classify and to know how to identify which one of those is going to be dangerous or be really dangerous and repeat. And this is why we create this kind of legislation, to try to encompass what we assess as being most dangerous. And often the assessment is subjective, of course. It's clinical, based on psychiatric or psychological assessments, and of course these mental health professionals can get it wrong, or might overestimate, or might feel it's better or safer for the community to say they're an unacceptable risk. So I guess what I'm saying that the myth or the fear in the community that's spread by the media is probably greater than it really is. That the majority of these dangerous sex offenders who have committed heinous crimes do not reoffend. Okay. So I'm talking, 80%, or 93%. Between 80 and 93%. If we look at world research, about 20%, and Australian research, about 7 to 13. So that's a comforting thought. At least we know that something working, what corrective services can be proud about is that they can argue that their strict supervision regimes are having some impact and some protection to the community. They can also argue that subjecting them to sexual offending and sexual treatment. And also some of these men, the most dangerous of them, are subjected to anti-adenoid treatment to reduce their testosterone levels, which also reduces their fantasizing about it. And they're subjected to weekly or fortnightly or monthly treatment with psychiatrists or psychologists. So there are a lot of protective factors there being put in place. But the reality is you can't watch them 24 hours a day unless you've got them handcuffed to you. The good thing is the majority of them don't reoffend. The good thing is that those that are at risk, we know who they are. We have profiled them. They're in the system, and there are good mechanisms in place to monitor them, even in some cases for life, as you're aware of recent legislation last year or the year before, I forget, has made it a life monitoring for some people that fit that category of dangerousness. So there are mechanisms there. Some would argue that we should have public registers, as they do in America. I don't know if I'm in favour of that. It doesn't allow people, those who genuinely are wanting to change, get on with their lives. I mean, I had a sex offender that I he supervised 5 years ago. He rang me recently to say that he'd had a strange phone call. And I said, that sounds like entrapment from the police. And he hasn't offended for 30 odd years. So he's still being monitored.
Yeah.
He's well and truly, he'd served his 5 years on the Dangerous Sex Offenders Act. So yes, the police are very active in monitoring sites like Lecanto, the international advertising site where you will get sex offenders and deviants advertising through that system. You're aware of Lecanto?
No, I'm not.
Oh, sorry, Lecanto.
I have no.
Oh, well and truly here on the Gold Coast. It's an international advertising on the net, social media. It advertises all sorts of things, but people will advertise on there are interested in family sex. And sometimes that will be undercover police, federal police, undercover police, to try and get people to respond and end up meeting people. In fact, that's the main site where police are set up and say, oh, look, they will pretend they're a young mother with a 15-year-old daughter and interested in threesomes.
Right.
And then the guy will respond and pretend they're interested in the mother, and then they'll arrange to meet and she'll talk about a girl and they'll turn up to a cafe and, of course, the police will be there waiting for them. That's not an uncommon thing that happens on the Gold Coast here. But that's called Lecanto, L-A-L-A-L-A, oh, I won't let people, don't want to encourage people to look it up, but it is a legitimate international advertising. I don't know how they're able to use it and why things aren't blocked like that in Australia, which could be done technically. And that is another thing which I think legislation could be done and they could be more proactive on is actually organising people like Google to block child pornography and deviant pornography and underage pornography and bestiality.
Well, what Elon Musk has done on Twitter would show that it's extremely easy to do very quickly. And he's, to his credit, has come down hard on any of that sort of material on Twitter.
Mm.
And the other platforms should take note.
Yes. Oh, yes. If you're serious about protecting children and stopping the trade, and I think the arguments to me about freedom of press fall away when it's illegal material we're dealing with, that it could be easily done. Certainly with some of my clients, you can get technology to block access to sex and pornography sites. But of course you can overcome that and you can just go on the black internet. Yeah.
Or you go on the black net and then everything opens up.
Yeah.
Just in closing, how do we look after our kids? How do we best look after our children? Knowing where they are for a start, knowing who they're with, educating them.
Mm.
It seems that quite often the victims of these sort of crimes become available to the perpetrators. Like you said, it's a situation where it's convenient. The child becomes available. So I suppose the best way to protect our child is to make sure that they don't become available.
Yes, I think creating open communication with your children, you've got to have a family environment in which children feel loved and valued and feel they can come to you. And that's something my mother was successful with me as a child. I remember as a young boy, I used to work as a paper boy at the Osborne Hotel. I used to call myself a used deliverer. My brother, who worked at the Sandgate Railway Station, he was a paper boy, but I was a used deliverer and so entrepreneurial. And where would I make my money? Guess what? Best Bets, they're still available, I think, Sportsman magazines on a Friday, and Picks and Post magazines, the girly magazines, I would sell them. And even the barmaids would ask me to go down and drive down the hill to get their women's magazines because you got a penny or a cent So if you sold something for 20 cents, like picks or pokes, as opposed to the paper at 4 cents or 5%, you made a lot more. And I remember, and this is my where I first heard about masturbation. I hadn't heard about it. I was only about 12. They used to have a, I don't know, a sexy bar, if you like, and they would have girls with low cut and sometimes no breasts, but I was allowed in there to sell papers. But it didn't mean anything to me at that age. But I can remember the barmaids would come up and give me a hug. Oh, can you go down and buy me a woman's magazine? And I would do that. And I was thinking of the money. And I can remember one of the barmen said to me, he'd say, oh, she's got great lugs. What are you talking about, lugs? What a lug. And he would and then he'd say, do you know about masturbation? He'd say, oh, you want to grab one of those magazines and go into the toilet. Had no idea what he was talking about. But that's when you started to learn about other things. And the other thing that drunken men used to do, they would try to grab hold of my genitals. But I would just push it away and say, pee off. Because my mother had talked to me and warned me about all these things. And I would have those conversations with mum. And it made me alert, even though I wasn't sexual or wasn't interested in sexual things at all at that age. I was a bit of a late bloomer. But because of that conversation, I became aware that there were dangerous men and dangerous men who would take you away and do things to you and my mother would share that with me. So having those conversations is very important. So awareness and information and knowledge is very powerful. But you're right. We can't smother our children. We can't be overprotective. We have to help them become resilient and be skilled, and we have to learn them to say no. And the pedophile will only target the very vulnerable person, the young child, the young boy or the young girl that's not likely to tell. The one that looks not to have many friends, the one that looks a bit lonely and vulnerable. And they're often children, unfortunately, who are from dysfunctional families and are become targeted to savvy men who will target these vulnerable women and be babysits and befriend them and even have a relationship with them so they can have access to their children. Very hard to protect your children in those kinds of situations because we're dealing with, again, poverty and lack of education and people who sometimes may be desensitized to abuse. Some women who have experienced abuse themselves, happened to me, I'm okay. And some men are like that, it happened to me, it's okay. So you have that in intergenerational. But, it is, I think, creating an environment where children are taught to say, no, don't do that. Mummy says no. I will tell. I've got four children. They're all adults. One's a boy. But my three girls, my children, when they were very young, I would sit them around in a circle and I would teach them bad touches and good touches. And a social work friend of mine had written a book, and I think it's still available, called Bad Touches and Good Touches.
Okay.
And it's about a storybook teaching children about what are good hugs, what are bad hugs, and where should a person not be touching, and just little things like that so they know mummy said don't touch there, you're not allowed to touch there. And building those assertion skills are probably the most powerful protective measures you can do for your children.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming and joining us today. Mm-hmm. Time's just flown. It's been such a pleasure. Mm-hmm. I hope you will come back again.
Thank you. Be delighted. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening to another episode of Crime Scene Gold Coast with Guardian Criminal Law. We're enjoying bringing you these podcasts on a weekly basis, and we look forward to bringing you many more. We've got a Patreon page where you can subscribe. That'll assist us in bringing you future episodes, and also any money raised through that goes towards a youth help program that we're running. We look forward to your company for many months to come. Thank you.